Hi, friend. It's Brittany Moses.
And Ranella Kalagithi.
And you're listening to Speaking Our Minds, the podcast that brings you honest and nuanced conversations around mental health, holistic wellness, and the real complexities of what it means to be human in the challenges of today's world, where we have fun, fascinating, and meaningful discussions around how to live a more insightful, connected, and whole life from the inside out. Joined by guest professionals, thought leaders, and some of my friends and those with lived experience. As always, we ask that you keep in mind that the views and opinions shared here are respectively held by each individual and is not a substitute for professional care or an alternative to seeking personal help from your clinician or provider and is ours to discern. We're so glad you're here. Follow the conversation on Instagram at SpeakingOurMindsPod and sit with us because we're diving in. This podcast episode is brought to you by WeShare by UHSM, a unique healthcare membership on a mission to create holistic wellness for the mind, body, and spirit. I'm honored to partner with UHSM and its community of faithful members. Together, we plan to create more awareness and programs around mental health and the role it plays in our overall balanced health. If you or someone you know is frustrated with their current healthcare, I encourage you to inquire about membership options at www.weshare.org or call 1-800-900-8476. Welcome back to another episode of the Speaking Our Minds podcast. This is Brittany.
And this is Ranella.
And we're back together again.
I know. It's been a minute and it's been so nice to just chat with you for literally the past hour.
I know. I love a duo episode where we get to chat. It's a new month. And, you know, all this past month, we've been, you know, talking about evolving faith and deconstruction and purity culture and religious trauma and all these things and had some really amazing conversations. And so, you know, we're just kind of shifting gears here, but also kind of taking some parts of that.
I know. I hope you guys go back to listen to March's episodes because we had a lot of traction there. A lot of people were really interested in those topics, and I think they're really relevant. And I had, you know, both of us had a lot of fun recording them. So,
yes. And so we decided we're going to kick off this episode with a Q&A episode, which we haven't done in a little while, but I always love these. We love just hearing from you guys, any questions that you have that you just want us to talk about and discuss here, because honestly, you guys kind of come up with the best content and the best questions that I think other people are wondering about and asking, which is why we love doing these.
Yes. And stay tuned for the rest of the month because we got some great, great topics on women's empowerment coming up for you. Deconstructing patriarchy and getting into all the issues that have to do with being a woman and validating our own experiences and also understanding kind of what we can do as men and women to continue to empower the people around us. So we're really excited about the upcoming episodes.
Oh, I can't wait for those. And I know we'll even touch a little bit on that today with one of our questions. But one of the first questions that we got are, I'd love to hear more about anger as part of the grieving process. And I think I got this question because I posted about it a couple weeks ago, basically about how anger is actually sometimes a sign of disappointment and grief and deep disappointment. So like sometimes we forget that anger is a part of the grieving process, right? And it's processing a deep disappointment. You know, you are disappointed about how you thought things should have been, and you're angry about that, or you're disappointed with how someone has treated you or mistreated you, and you've become disillusioned with the relationship, and you're angry about that. You're angry that this person isn't who you thought they were, or this relationship isn't what you thought it was. Maybe you're disappointed with how someone responded to you. Or you're disappointed, you know, you're grieving the disappointment of expecting better from our leaders and institutions. You're grieving the disappointment of hoping for better from our humanity in the way that we're responding to each other. So, like, I know for me,
I've found that my anger and frustration makes room for clarity and compassion when I give myself to the space to grieve some of the hopes and losses that I've had with life, with people, within myself, when I can kind of name the hurt and set the boundaries. And so, yeah, I think that's really been big for me. It's like recognizing when you're feeling angry about something, there's probably also deep down something that you're grieving about what's been lost, or a disappointment or expectation that's been dropped that has been hurtful to you.
Yeah, and as we're just kind of jumping straight into like grief here and grieving, there's when we think of grief, sometimes we just think of loss and we think of losing someone or the grief, that whole like deep grieving process. And I think one of the things we don't realize is that every day there is something that we are grieving in small ways. And the older I got, the more this became my motto, which is life is a series of mini grieving processes.
So
And
true.
that, even though it's like a really melancholy thought, it helps me manage my expectations because grief really just is a lack of expectations, like a series of disappointments. And if we don't know how to properly feel all the emotions that come with being utterly disappointed, or even disappointed in small ways, that can be really difficult. I think that when we find ourselves in a space where we are constantly disappointed or constantly grieving, maybe constantly angry, that's a time to ask ourselves if potentially we are trying to hold on to or control things in our lives a little too much.
That's good.
Because life is so unpredictable, people are so incredibly unpredictable. And that can be really hard for some types of personalities, especially if you grew up in a very unpredictable home. As an adult, you might be a little bit slightly more controlling because you want to control, you want more predictability. But I'm just going to tell you right here and now that that's going to be a really tough way to live life, and it's going to make it tough for the people around you too. And so one of the best things you can do is to learn how to grieve well. And part of that does include being angry and being able to feel that anger. So I don't know, like, what does that look like for you, Brittany, to like
Oh my
feel
gosh.
that anger and be angry through the grieving process, but not allow it to like overtake you?
Yeah, it's interesting because when everything that you're saying is even something I'm practicing now, and that's that kind of acceptance piece, not necessarily settling for like less than what you deserve or anything like that, but like being accepting of the fact that life is messy, humans are messy, and how do I take care of myself through those things? So actually for me, it took a while to feel something like anger, especially in when I was in a socially constructed community where anger is seen as like a bad emotion. Like especially for women as well, it's just like anger is seen as like unbecoming or improper, or like you need to. Now I'm getting into like terms that I heard, which is like forgive as fast as you want God to forgive you, right? And I look at stuff like that now
Oh,
and I'm like, oh my gosh, like this
I
idea
have
that
never
you
heard
need to,
that, but that sounds
yeah. I mean, I
terrible.
heard stuff like that where it's like you need to forgive quickly. And now, knowing what I know about grief and psychology and everything, it's like, no, you need time to process what has happened to you. And you're allowed to take like the boundaries that you need. And you need to kind of move through that naturally for yourself. And so for me, I think it's just been like being able to name anger, right? Or even feel it and say, okay, no, this isn't just me. Like I was maybe treated wrongly, or I was violated in some way, or my boundaries were overstepped in some way, or I wasn't respected in some way. And once you can actually recognize that within your sense of self, then you can kind of feel angry. Like I think angry is a healthy emotion because I think it means you're actually connected to yourself and the truth of your situation and like the reality of your situation. And when you're a people pleaser, I think that you kind of bypass that entire emotion because you internalize everything as something wrong with you or what you could have done better or right. So like I learned that anger is a healthy emotion. And so when it comes up, naming it, but then also going a little bit deeper and saying, okay, now like, why am I angry? What's been violated? Like, where is this coming from? Or what am I disappointed about? And how do I need to take space from this? Because I was going through this with social media a lot recently with just a lot of the discourse online where you feel like nothing a person can do or say is ever going to be right. There's, you know, there's this constant othering online. There's a lot of just not really humane ways that people are talking to one another or having these conversations. And I just felt really disappointed with humanity, like looking at comments, reading comments, looking at certain posts that are just really like dehumanizing or self-righteous or bitter or superior. Like, you know, I just found myself angry, like with social media and the world. I mean, like it's and feeling like there's only so much I can do. So I had to take a step back. I had to take a little space from social media and remind myself of the beautiful things in the world. I started painting. I started crocheting. I started kind of slowing down and enjoying the more beautiful aspects of life and kind of reminding myself of the beautiful things. So I think going back to your question, it's like naming the anger, kind of recognizing where it might be coming from. What am I disappointed in? What am I grieving here? What that's hurting me? What boundaries do I need to create around this situation as I'm getting clarity on it? But also, how can I take care of myself and kind of pivot myself also to things that bring me life and that feedback into me with joy and happiness and gratitude has been a way that I like take care of myself.
Yeah, I love that. And it's really interesting because like you were saying, men are typically allowed, like that is the one emotion they're allowed to feel is anger. And yet for women, that's one that they're not allowed to feel and not allowed to exhibit and show that emotion. But I think underlying anger, even if we were to go a little bit deeper, is that feeling of sadness and disappointment. And being able to access that feeling at its proper time is also, I think, a very helpful way to process grief. Because again, we don't want to bypass anger and say, oh, that's not a good emotion. Like all emotions and feelings are valid and they all need to be felt. But at the end of the day, if you're experiencing inner bitterness and anger that is maybe causing you to not, you know, because hopefully the cycle of grief, you know, ends in acceptance and kind of starts over again from, you know, any other kind of experience that you have, but it typically hopefully ends in acceptance. When you experience that anger and that bitterness, absolutely let yourself feel that and experience it. And like you said, pinpoint what it is you're angry about, but maybe even go a layer deeper and ask like, this is actually making me really angry because there's something I'm deeply sad about. I'm deeply disappointed in someone or something. Maybe it's because, you know, I'm angry at this person because they never listened to me, that, you know, I have to repeat myself so many times, like, and yes, that's frustrating. So that might be like that emotion that you can access most quickly is that frustration of like, why can't you listen? Why won't you do this? Like, but maybe underlying that is just this feeling of like, you just don't care. Like, you don't care about me. You don't care about my happiness. You don't care about, and then at that point, when you pinpoint what's actually making you sad, it helps you at that point is when you can start having the types of effective conversations, both with yourself and with the person. Because if you're operating on the level of anger, you won't really be able to have a very, you know, effective conversation. Definitely feel the feeling, but if you're trying to resolve things and understand this process a little bit more or come to the place of acceptance or closure, it is important to get down to essentially the place of sadness and disappointment, because that's actually where we can have productive conversations and where we can actually resolve those feelings of like, hey, this is how it made me feel. I'm very angry, but mostly it made me feel disappointed about this. So I need to change my expectations, or I want, you know, this is how I'm interpreting this, the meaning. I'm interpreting it as you don't care for me. Therefore, I'm very disappointed. You know, because obviously if someone meant to not care for you and they were, say, your partner or your husband, of course it would be really hurtful. Most likely they don't mean to not care for you. It's just the way our brains interpret it. Yeah. And so anyway, it's just a really, you know, I think as we've been talking about, it's a really important emotion to have, but there are deeper layers, like feel that feeling and then go down into the sadness, into the disappointment, and then try having a productive conversation.
Yeah, I like that idea of even being able to tell someone like, hey, I just need to gather my thoughts around this. And then like, I'm happy to talk about this like at a better time, and even be able to set that boundary. So like you said, you're not responding out of anger. You know, maybe I know for me, I need to like collect my thoughts, and then it's like, yeah. And then I think what I'm seeing a lot too is anger with institutions. So, and that's something that I felt too, whether it's governmental, political, or religious, you can see a lot of people that are very angry, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that deep down, it's because people are disappointed. Maybe they feel like their religious community or institution is not operating the way that they feel that it should, or isn't operating humanely, or isn't treating people the way that they should, or isn't living up to the values that they believed that this institution should be living up to, you know, in what they're showing and what they're sharing. Or maybe there's been scandals, or maybe there's, right? And so you have some people who are coming off as angry. And I think that there are some people who judge that. And it's like, let's consider like, there's a lot of disappointment there. There's a lot of hurt there of like, man, I really trusted in this institution. I really believed in this institution. And I'm actually really hurt because it's not what I thought it was supposed to be, you know, at least maybe on the way to them finding something like a healthier community. And I see that and I'm just like, oh, okay. Like there's hurt there, you know, even same with like, again, politically. Or the government, maybe you feel like, you know, we should be doing this for our country. We should be doing this for people in our nation. Like these are the values that we should be, whatever it is. And you're upset because maybe you feel like humanity is not matching up to the expectations of how we think, you know, maybe the world should be operating or people should be helped or supported or whatever it is. And so I think that I want to point that out, like in all the kind of discourse that we're seeing in the world, whether it's nationally, politically, or religiously, a lot of that anger is coming from sometimes a hurt place from people and in a disappointment in, you know, structures. And that's valid too.
Right. And there's so many areas of our lives that we experience grief and experience anger. And another area of life could just be with yourself, you know, in that grieving process. Maybe it's a mistake that you made. Maybe it's a mistake that you made for years and years and years and years and years. Maybe it's an identity that you realize you had and you're really mad at yourself for having that, you know, for identifying with that or just who you were in your past life. I know I've experienced that myself, you know, as someone who I look back on my life and for several years wasn't truly living in authenticity to myself, because quite frankly, I couldn't. I was not in the headspace and the heart space to like know even how to do that. And I didn't have the permission. And now that I do, looking back, there is, you know, I think anger is a really important emotion to have, even if it is directed at yourself for a little while, you know, and to expect that in the grieving process, you're going to be angry at yourself for a good minute, you know, like, I think it's probably taken me you know, 3 or 4 years to stop being angry at myself. And for some people that lasts longer, just depending on how aware you are of it and how much compassion you're allowed to give you allow yourself to have. But sometimes during that process of grieving, you know, we grieve the loss of identities that we thought would stick around forever. And, you know, we grieve the loss of who we once were, grieve the loss of, you know, we grieve the things that we've done. And anger is a huge part of that, because that's what allows us to kind of teach our brains never again.
Right.
Like to teach our minds, like there's a little bit of disgust there, I think, when we're angry towards ourselves. And that can very much be tied into self-shame. And that can be tied into guilt. And again, all of those are healthy in the space that it needs to exist, because our minds, bodies, and spirits know when a certain emotion is like ready to be on its way out. It needs to move through our bodies. Like you can't just skip over some of this grieving process, including anger. So you have to let it be in your system. Let yourself feel the feelings. Very, very uncomfortable to hate yourself. I've been there.
Or
very uncomfortable.
World.
To be angry, to like, you know, but once you've had a little bit of time, I think there does come a moment when, you know, hopefully if you can find those quiet moments with yourself and be really in tune and say, okay, I think that at this point, anger is no longer serving me in the grieving process. And it is time for me to practice now accepting myself and accepting my story and accepting that like life happened the way it had to happen, not the way it was meant to, but just the way it had to. And I'm still a good person. I'm still moving forward. I'm still doing, you know, what I know best, and hopefully moving into more of acceptance. But I do love this question because I think society does kind of make anger look like really bad or unwanted.
Yeah, I just love that we're talking about it in such a holistic way and framing it in this way, like as grief, as a form of self-protection, and that it doesn't have to be destructive, but it can actually move us through a natural emotional process to acceptance. I wish that this was framed this way to me, like so much earlier in life. So I appreciate this question. Our next question.
Let's
our next question.
Let's move on. Our next question is another question that is one that we're going to expound on fully in a future episode. But this one is actually not a question.
It's not.
Someone just said, deconstructing patriarchy. Oh my gosh, is something we're still doing. And if you're a woman listening to this, and if you're a man, or you know, however you identify, this affects you. This 100% affects you, whether you realize it or not. Why don't you give us a little,
I love that you said whether you realize it or not, because I don't think I realized it, right?
Oh, no.
Until I got older, then it was like, because I was living within the narrative, I actually wasn't aware of how much I internalized that was actually affecting like my selfhood. Not only that, but like the way I moved through the world, even like my sense of safety, like so many things. There's a lot here. And like you said, Ranella, we're going to have to dedicate a lot of time to this in a future episode, but I think just touching on it for now, when I think of this question, it just goes back to the idea that we are born into narratives that are already existing, right? Like when we come into this world, we don't come into a blank slate. There are already narratives existing about what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what is socially acceptable, what is culturally acceptable, what is seen as good or bad or right. And we internalize these ideas, whether it's messages from our family, messages from our religious community, messages from media, what have you. So that's the first thing I want to say is recognizing that patriarchy is a construct. It's a societal construct that we were born into because it's been a very dominating construct for a long period of time. However, just because there is a dominant narrative, that doesn't mean that that's the only narrative that exists and that there aren't other alternative ways of being. I remember when I was taking anthropology at UCLA, we were talking about matrilineal societies. And I thought that was so cool. It's like, wait, there are societies that exist that are actually like matrilineal. And yeah, anthropologists have identified that there are at least 160 matrilineal societies that exist. They tend to be indigenous, and there are examples such as indigenous groups in North America, like the Iroquois and the Hopi, parts of Africa, such as the Khasi in India, and some others in Southeast Asia. So like, there have been matrilineal societies that exist. And
when you say matrilineal, mm-hmm. we're talking about like matriarchal, like
with,
where women are kind of the ones that are, and maybe you can, you know, not to cut you off, maybe you can define patriarchy after this, but yeah, just to clarify, matrilineal.
Yeah. So matrilineal is in terms of like lineage, inheritance, familial relationships are all traced through the maternal line rather than the paternal line. Also, you know, property and social status are passed down from like mother to daughter, and kinship determined through the family line. So, it's kind of the opposites that's happening. Obviously, in a typical patriarchal society, you know, men are kind of the dominating authoritative figure. They tend to have they're in the hierarchy of power and control. They tend to have the dominant narrative. And so, you know, when thinking about this, we weren't obviously always patriarchal when looking at history. People tend to think that this changed during the time when agriculture came to be, right? The horticulture in history, when the farming systems began. However, men and women were both working in the fields. They believe that the first clearer signs of women being treated differently than men appeared much later in like the first states of Mesopotamia around like today's Iraq, Syria, and Turkey, where, you know, the elites in this society needed people to be able to not only like produce resources, but also during this time as societies or people groups and tribes are breaking off and you have like alliances and you have enemies, you need some people who are also going to be willing to risk their lives to protect the tribe and to protect your society. And so because women were needed for reproduction and to, you know, continue the population and to sustain and build the population, oftentimes it was men who would go out and fight, you know, and risk their lives and conquer and defend the state and what have you, because there was pressure on maintaining population levels, which would have women put into a role of being more expected to focus on having babies, you know, and kind of taking care of things at home. And so that's where you begin to see a shift. So I say all that to say that a lot of time, again, these narratives come about because maybe there was some historical necessity at that time, and then it continues to get carried over into later generations. But like you see today, and we're not in those same situations, right? Just because something existed at an earlier time in history doesn't mean that those same exact functions are needed now in that way. But we often carry things and we carry systems along with us if we do not kind of challenge some of these narratives that lead to more equality and like, what really are the purposes of this? And does it really serve everyone? And is this really a system that's still good for all of us? Are really the questions for today.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Especially just thinking of how we are born into a society that already has all of these assumptions. And, you know, patriarchy is a system of power, you know, where men are basically marked as inherently more worthy than women, or than the idea of like femininity. And they're given more access to power, resources, even knowledge. And it also sends a message. It sends this message that women deserve less, that they deserve less money, less freedom, less, strength. And it's really interesting how that translates into everyday life, because sometimes these very deep underlying belief systems, because they're just so widely accepted, we don't even recognize it, like you were saying.
Yeah.
And especially for many of us who grew up in the Christian church, like I did, those two things are just so completely blended, because you have people who are taking what the Bible says and interpreting it through the lens of society and through the lens of culture.
Right.
And so if the dominant culture is a patriarchal system, of course, you're going to read the Bible and read your sacred text through the lens of, you know, men are the head of the household and all of that type of thing. And that has just translated. I mean, if you are a woman who grew up in the Christian world, and even if you didn't grow up in the Christian world, you are still living in a country that, although many people don't go to church anymore, still have roots, like major roots in evangelicalism or in, you know, the
puritanical
Protestant.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So like people are like, oh no, we live in a really secular society. I'm like, I understand that people are choosing differently now, but the way you were raised and your parents and your grandparents, those run deep. And so that still kind of colors the view. And so some of the ways that this, the ways we can see it in society is obviously, like you were talking about, the use of the family name of the man. So, you know, for some people in more traditional, upbringings, the idea that a woman would not take her husband's name is just ludicrous. It's like,
oh my gosh.
Wow, you are, you know, whatever it is, it's just like you don't respect men. You're just this liberal feminist that does, you know, and it's just really sad that that has to be the meaning that's assigned to it, versus someone that a woman who is a human, who has her own freaking choice, who just wants to keep her own last name for whatever reason she's decided.
And I just
also, yeah,
add to that real quick, because that literally is my story, because I did so many things publicly in the name Brittany Moses, from my book to like my degrees from school are in my name, right? And then like if I go on and continue, right? But then I got married in the middle of that. So my marriage last name is Stoll. But that was something I had to battle with, also with even my publishers and different things. Like, do I change my name and then my work doesn't directly connect to this, all this work that I've done in my name, right? Doesn't directly connect. Or like, if I go on to get my, you know, doctoral degree, like, do I do it in my husband's name? So that's something I know a lot of women in general, but especially in like higher education also struggle with. And you're just like, oh my gosh, these are things I have to think about that like men don't have to think about, you know, because they carry the same name throughout their whole lives. So it's like things like that, like, yeah, that directly affects how I move through and show up in the world with my own accomplishments and different things.
Yeah.
So you said that and I'm like, oh, that's literally what I had to deal with.
No, absolutely. Because, and we're affected by it so much. You listen to songs that talk about, then she'll take my last name, you know, like it's just part of society, which is like no shame or shade to anyone at all who takes, you know, someone's, I mean, my last name's kind of hard. I might take my husband's last name, just to be honest. Like, and everyone gets, you know, to choose that, but the expectation that that is the way it's supposed to be in order for you to truly respect the marriage. Or, I mean, I think that's the part that's, you know, and so other ways that it kind of exemplifies in society today, obviously gender pay gaps. People are like, oh, everyone gets paid the same now. Well, you know, I mean, this is a battle that has been being fought for literally over 100 years or more. So I just find it really interesting when people try to minimize the efforts of men and women who are trying to give women equal pay or equal access.
Or equal work. Yes.
Exactly. It's like, oh, no, we're equal now. It's like, this is still going on. I mean, it's all very clear. So anyway, society being fundamentally biased towards men, whether that's in TV movies, at the workplace, as a society, we are still biased towards men and biased towards like their strength, their abilities, how they can get the job done. Unpaid care work mostly
Yeah.
performed by women. That's still very much unaccounted for in society. What the things that women do, I mean, I think they've like counted, they've counted like how much that would actually cost someone to do all the
Yes.
things that a woman does. And it's like, it's a whole full-time job,
Yeah.
full like annual salary with
And
benefits.
it also like puts a pause on your career that like a man might not have to worry about. Like he can continue to go on with his career and therefore can make more money because he's had the time to excel in his career further, as to where you might have had to put a hold on your career because, or you couldn't continue school or you couldn't continue growing in your field because you had to stay home and like raise the kids, or bear the babies or whatever it is. And like, if you want to do that, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Like, but it does show like also the way our society is structured. Like, it could be structured differently, but in the way that it is structured, the woman does automatically kind of take a hit to her aspirations. And it's kind of assumed, right? Like, it's assumed that the woman's going to stay home because the woman has more pay, like, has longer leave than men have leave. That's starting to change a little bit. But even that, it's like assuming the woman's the one that's going to be home rather than the man once the baby's born. And I mean, they're
Exactly.
just
And I
assumptions
think
that
there
are built
was,
in.
and there was this, I forgot who was sharing, talking about just the idea that when a woman gets to the time when she's like moving up to middle management or top management,
Yes.
that is the time when now, the kids are maybe grown, but now the parents are starting to need the attention of the mother. And so either way, as a woman, it's like,
Yes. The
at any
sandwich generation, we call it.
right, like at any
Yeah.
part of your life and career, it is very difficult. And like, we're not saying that there's just like this absolute solution for it all. I do think that as women, the fact that we bear children and that we've been told that we're the nurturers and of society, that has definitely played a role in all of this. But I think it just sheds light on the fact that policy-wise, as well as how men treat women and the access that we have and everything like that just needs to be taken into consideration because women just really bear a lot of the relational burden all throughout their
Yeah.
lives. And so then there's also the failure to talk about women's achievements, unequal distribution of household tasks as just like, an assumption that women are the ones that are better in the household, and even women being punished or looked down upon for obtaining leadership roles, making decisions, showing independence. An empowered woman in her 30s and 40s is very much like there's these assumptions about her that,
Yeah.
she's never gonna find a man, she's never gonna get married, she's never gonna, as if that's like, obviously the most terrible thing in the world. But all of those things are ways in which women
Yeah.
are affected by patriarchy, and that can have a direct effect on your sense of self, your sense of confidence, the feeling and the need maybe in relationships to minimize who you are and to,
Yeah.
focus on this one identity that you've been given, which is to be in the home and be a soft, girl who is feminine and who likes feminine things and doesn't, doesn't ruffle any feathers or give her opinions. So
Yeah.
those are just some ways in which it can affect us in day-to-day life.
Yeah. I think the problem with that is not that someone wants to stay at home or live a feminine soft life, because I hear that, I'm like, that sounds lovely. Right? It's the fact that women are dichotomized into either or, this or that. Like, they're constantly dichotomized, and that's kind of the issue. But also, there's a big conversation about how it can be bad for women, but we also like to highlight that patriarchy is not good for men, because
no.
it also dichotomizes men. And that's where we get this kind of toxic hypermasculinity, where then men are not allowed to be in touch with themselves. They're not allowed to be in touch with their emotional health. They're kind of stunted in, you know, this idea where they have these rigid standards to be kind of stoic and have dominance. And so we see how mental health stats are so can be so underreported with men, because maybe they're not allowed to feel, so they can feel anger, but they can't feel sadness because that shows weakness, or they can't have a more nurturing side because that's seen as being effeminate, right? So like, we also cut off and mute the full identity of men when we have these patriarchal, you know, narratives that dichotomize men and women. And then going back to the dominance piece, I think just a real harmful effect of it is violence against women. You know, like 95% of violence is men against women, you know, and patriarchy can play a huge role in that domestic violence, sexual assault, you know, when women are objectified or seen as the weaker being, or, you know, this gender-based violence rooted in power imbalance and, you know, is perpetuated by norms that prioritize male authority over women and women's bodies. And so I think that's really concerning. You know, as a woman, for me, just having a thought where it's like, anywhere I go in the world, anytime I walk around, I am constantly thinking about my safety because men exist in the world. Like, I don't want men to not exist, but at the same time, that feeling of, oh, my safety is constantly at risk because we exist in a culture where men can take violence upon you like at any time. And so I'm actually perpetually unsafe, like in the world. Does that mean that I think something's always going to happen to me? No, I'm not living in a state of paranoia, but that is a constant underlying feeling that, and I always, and me and Jason have had these conversations, like he is experiencing the world very differently than I'm experiencing the world. He is moving through the world very differently than I'm moving through the world. He has to worry about, like, you know, things happening to him, but like not to the extent that I'm worried about things happening to me when I'm walking through just like the neighborhood or the street or the world. Like, we are living in two different worlds.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm like constantly, again, it's not a paranoia thing, but every once in a while, if I'm walking, I'm looking behind my shoulder.
Yeah.
Or if I'm going out from the store and going to my car, I have my keys in my hand right away.
In case you need to stab them in the eyes. Do you werewolf your keys where you keep them in between the knuckles? Like,
I haven't done that, but I probably should. But yeah, just like in these little ways, especially at night, or if you're, you know, around a lot of men and there aren't a lot of women. I mean, it's just like just ways that you're hyper aware. I don't go running ever when it's dark in the morning.
That feeling of even when you're in the gym with men, you know, versus like, I even just think about what if, like how you'd feel in an all female gym versus
my friend goes to one and she said it's like incredible.
It's probably so liberating. Like, you're not having to worry about like your body being ogled, like any of those things, right? So that's the other part of patriarchy. It's like the constant self-consciousness of just existing in your body because of the way women's bodies have been objectified and sexualized under this culture. So anyway, oh my gosh, as we said, this could be its own entire episode, and it will be.
And you know, I want to say that like all the things that we've said, like if you're a man listening to this, I can definitely see if I was a man listening to women being like, I'm scared of men. I, you know, like they're always looking at me, like all of this stuff. I can see how that would be threatening, and how, especially if you are a man who grew up with a patriarchal mindset, this would be threatening. I think it's so liberating as a woman to be able to witness men as I get older and older, especially as I've gotten to my 30s and I meet more and more men who are so secure in themselves.
Oh my gosh.
And who also have separated themselves from needing to identify with a patriarchal mindset to be able to have these conversations without getting triggered or feeling this sense of threat to their masculinity. And I think that's kind of how you know that you're not right. part of a patriarchal mindset, is if you're listening to women talk about their very real vulnerable experiences and it doesn't become about you.
Oh, right.
That's, you know, like if it doesn't become about you, then the shoe doesn't fit and you don't have to get threatened and you don't have to feel like, yes. oh, they're talking about me, like I'm the one that's going to come hurt them. If you know you're the person that's empowering women, that is giving them permission to be themselves, who is protecting them, then you have no reason right. to actually be threatened by when women speak about these things. But I can see how some men would be, especially if they identify with kind of that form narrative. Of masculinity.
Right. Listen, that is why I married my husband. Okay.
I love that.
He is so like, oh my gosh. He's just very like secure in himself. And yeah. I know that I can talk to him about these things and he's not threatened by it because he knows that that's not him. And he agrees. Right. He's like, oh no, because he loves and cares for me and wants to protect me. And he also was raised with three sisters that might help. I don't know. But like, yeah, I definitely, you're right. I think you can definitely see whether or not someone kind of like aligns with this narrative as a part of their identity or masculinity or what have you by how threatened or offended they get by a conversation that really is intended just for the good and well-being of women and their health and safety and overall right. well-being, as well as men, you know, mm-hmm. as a whole. So
this is a big topic. It affects so many people. And just 5 or 10 years ago, I would not be having this conversation. And so I'm really grateful for the evolvement of, you know, of life. And, yeah. you know, especially like if you're a woman listening to this and you were, you know, excited about the things that we're talking about because it's validating your experiences, then stay tuned for our yeah. full episode on deconstructing patriarchy.
And if you're like in the church and this was like a really big part of your indoctrination, I highly recommend the book, The Making of Biblical Womanhood by Beth Allison Barr. And I appreciate this too, because she actually also comes from a biblical perspective, if that's something that you need to connect with, actually about how what Jesus was doing was countercultural mm-hmm. and it was actually equalizing and uplifting women during a very patriarchal time. And so, yeah, again, it depends on what narrative you're getting, right? You can get a narrative that supports these systems, but you can also find a narrative, an alternative narrative in there of what Jesus is doing that very much isn't living that out. And so right. just I encourage doing more reading and more research about this. That also means like you don't have to abandon your faith. There is other contexts for these types of conversations.
Awesome. Okay, so getting into our last question here. Individuation. I love how these questions are actually not questions, they're like statements. So, but the person wrote individuation and differentiation as an important part of human development. This one's really important.
Yes.
This is big.
Yeah, because I feel like we've used these words a lot throughout the podcast. So I think it'll be good to help kind of define them a little bit more. About the idea of what is individuation, what is differentiation, why is it important to our development? You know, individuation more so comes from the analytical psychology of Carl Jung, you know, in terms of being aware of yourself as a distinct and separate person with your own unique thoughts, feelings, identity, sense of self, and convictions, right? And so the goal is to kind of have the self-realization of developing into an authentic self, right? That is true as to who you are, your makeup, the way that you think. Differentiation is kind of the process of distinguishing yourself from others and having a clear sense of identity and autonomy. So they're very similar. I kind of use them interchangeably, you know, but this actually comes from a theory by Murray Bowen, who's really in the like family systems therapy. And he believes that this is like really important, especially within like a dysfunctional family unit, to be able to simultaneously have connection with others while also being able to differentiate yourself and have your own sense of identity. So it's kind of a balance between connection, but also having autonomy. So, and that both of those are important. So yeah, these are important parts of identity formation and just becoming ourselves. It's good for our psychological well-being. It just benefits our relationships when we are bringing our true selves to the table. We're not abandoning ourselves, you know? And yeah, I just think this is a skill even. Sometimes it doesn't come naturally because it's so normal to conform, right, to our environments and to people around us and to look outside of us to try to assess like who we should be and what we should be doing in the world. I think that's so natural. And then as you get older, you kind of develop this skill of differentiation where you say, okay, like I value intimacy and connection with people, and that's very important, but also I can have the emotional boundaries to maintain my sense of self and my identity and have my own thoughts and feelings, and those can coexist is kind of what I get. They're basically like two kind of from two different like schools of thought, but they're kind of the same thing or similar.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, like you said, a skill, and it's easier if you grew up in a family that allowed you to be an individual who gave you permission, especially like express permission, you know, if you had siblings, if you had parents, you know, who are, you're just growing up in this system where everyone is an individual, but also a whole. There's the family identity, there's the family culture, the family expectations, the, you know, generational expectations. And so to be able to individuate yourself, I think, is actually kind of difficult unless you grew up in a home where one or both parents were really encouraging you to discover yourself and to discover your own ways of thinking, and giving you permission to have your own way of your own opinions and your own decisions at a certain point in life. That can be, you know, very difficult in a home where potentially you grew up maybe in a collectivist society. Maybe you grew up Asian, from South Asia, Southeastern Asia, you know, more of a society where you make decisions for the good of like the name of the family and the honor of the family. And that, and especially if you grow up in a home, an immediate family that is like that, but you actually physically live in America, or you physically live in a Western society that is much more individualistic, that poses actually like a very difficult space for your well-being. You know, that's very difficult for the different dynamics of the family. It can be very difficult to set boundaries, to have your own opinions, because the truth is when you have, like, for example, siblings, even if you're twins, I mean, but no matter how many years apart you are, every human is so different in your family. And I look at the three of me and my sisters and me, the three of us girls, I'm the middle. And my older sister and younger sister have things that they have so much in common with that I do not relate with at all. And vice versa, you know, my little sister and I have things that my older sister does not relate with. We are just so different from one another. And then we're all individually different from our parents. And so it is a skill that you build to learn that you are, especially if you're an adult and you're listening to this, I mean, most likely you're an adult, you're probably in your 20s, 30s and above. This is a good time to really start validating your own experiences, your own feelings, your own temperament, your own personality, interests, communication styles, while still being able to respect other people's. And what makes that difficult is when you have a family member that is extremely disappointed in who you are, who you've chosen to be, or doesn't allow you to have the decisions that you want to have. I mean, yeah, I mean, this is why people go to family therapy and why they go to individual therapy,
Literally.
because of the inability to individuate and give freedom to the other members of the family to individuate.
Yeah, or at the very least, like permission to yourself. Give permission to yourself, you know? It's interesting for me because actually I feel like my family allowed me to individuate. Like they allowed me to be creative and explore and try different things and be my own person and go down different routes and do whatever I wanted to do growing up and change courses. And I am really so grateful for that, like looking back now. However, it was actually when I got into certain religious communities where it was like, oh, you're not really allowed to individuate. Like you have to think, feel, believe all these things according to this system, according to what everybody else is. You're in danger of thinking differently. You're in danger of, you know what I mean, of feeling different or whatever it was. It was actually in those types of spaces where I was like, oh, in order, I didn't think this consciously, but I think subconsciously it was like, oh, you have to conform in order to fit into this community. And not conforming can cause, whether it's social ostracism or looking at you in misjudging your character, maybe as not spiritual enough or as not faithful enough or as deceived or in rebellion or like whatever it was, right? So I think that it was those experiences for me that was like, oh, like unity means that you don't differentiate. And now, kind of having grown and evolved, I realize that that is not true. Like, unity and conformity are not the same thing. Unity is when you have differences that come together and they make up a whole. Conformity is saying, in order to belong, in order to be accepted, you have to think, feel, believe like us, and you have to conform to this one group identity. And kind of abandon yourself in the process, your intuition, your convictions, your thoughts, your opinions. And I think that's cultish. I don't think that's healthy at all. I don't think it's how we are created to exist as humans with differences. And so, red flag for me. But yeah, now looking back, it's like, oh no, I think this is again a really important skill that I had to learn that, oh, I can be, especially also as a people pleaser, right? It's like, oh no, I can be kind, be loving, I can be in community and connection to people. And it doesn't mean I have to automatically chameleon and conform to whatever I think I need to be or other people want me to be. Like, I can still be my own person. And in fact, when I am, I add something different to the table and I add something valuable to the table by being myself in the way that are my strengths and the way that I think in my perspectives in my, in all of that. And I actually want to hear people's different outlooks. I was reading this book called When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi. He was one letter off from you, not Kalanithi.
Kalagithi.
And one of his
And he's Indian.
and he is Indian, and this book just like this book just like wrecked me. But one of the lines that he said, because he was kind of like searching for meaning in his life through like literature and the medical field and biology and all these things. And one of the things I highlighted that he said in the book was, human knowledge is never contained in one person. It grows from the relationships we create between each other and the world, and it is still never complete. So I love that because he was kind of like on this quest for like meaning and knowledge. And then he realizes like, oh, like there's too much kind of in the world and in humanity for one person to know, to retain, to hold. It's actually through all of the experiences with one another that we kind of get a more holistic perspective of what it means to be human and what it means to exist in the world and the different viewpoints that are valid within existence. And so I personally want to hear that. Like I actually like when things are just repetitively said over and over again and we're all saying the same things. I mean, it happens, it's fine, but like I really appreciate when people are allowed to kind of go in their spaces and really think kind of for themselves and come to their own, even if it's not necessarily popular. Like it's like, okay, well, at least you thought about it for yourself. I can appreciate that. Yeah. So anyway, so I appreciate individuation. Personally, I like to be around people who are individuated. I tend to draw to people who are individuated, who are just, you know, kind of like, I love you, but also I respect my thoughts and, you know, feelings, opinions, even if we don't agree. Like,
Yeah. I think that's, it's really easy to be around those people because you don't have to try to guess, what they're thinking and feeling. People who are individuated tend to be able to speak up about their boundaries. And they also tend to be able to be flexible, you know, like they, you kind of know what battles to pick and choose because you know very clearly what matters to you and what values matter to you and what areas you're willing to fudge on. But having been someone who had to really learn how to individuate myself, I had, and, you know, some people can really relate with this, I'm sure, but I had all the things kind of come at me from, you know, being that middle second born child who in my mind success looked like being like my sister and doing what she did. So again, you know, it kind of started off with this lack of sense of self. And even though my parents were very empowering, it was just a story I'd already accepted in my mind. And then on top of that, being an Asian, being a female, there are all those expectations that, you know, made me want to not individuate myself and just kind of conform and fit in. And then on top of that, going into a hyper-conservative world of Christianity where everything was laid out for me as far as how a woman should be, feel, think, and act and talk. So, you know,
so many intersectionalities for you that.
Yeah. And I'm still deconstructing all of that. Like I was just on a walk yesterday, like really for the first time looking at like seeing myself and seeing the last 15 years and how much I've really had to push through in order to be who I am today. And there are so many women who have gone through the same exact thing. And it's an incredibly empowering experience to feel and know that your thoughts, opinions, and feelings and experiences are completely valid. I mean, up to the point where, you know, I would get really scared if someone thought bad of me.
Yes.
Like I wasn't fitting in. I didn't do the right thing. I felt like a bad person, whether that was, whether that was with a church leader, whether that was in my own family. You know, I remember the first time my sister got really, really mad at me, my older sister. And I felt like, you know, and we're siblings, we fight, you know, all of that. And because I still felt like my self-worth and identity was tied up in her approval, it just shook me. It just like tore me down and I didn't know how to handle it. In her mind, she was like, we're having a disagreement. In my mind, I was like, you hate me and I'm a bad person and I'm a bad sister and I'm a bad da 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 da. And so of course we repaired and talked through things. And even with my little sister, you know, there are moments when even my own family members, obviously you're gonna have conflict.
Right.
And whenever that would be directed at me, my initial response was to say, like, oh my goodness, I didn't conform. I was the bad person. I should have done this. You're right. I should have done that. And that totally comes from my past experiences of feeling like who I was and my thoughts and opinions and beliefs and ideas were invalid and like everyone else's was. So I just had a very weak sense of self. And so this idea of individuation can be very hard to understand until you practice it. And there's a sense of release and letting go that you have in order to practice this. The letting go of needing people's approval, the letting go of feeling that your value is based on how many people like you, how many people agree with you, who agrees with you. And when you can know and accept that humans are different, we will disagree.
Yes.
And the people, the friends, the family who are meant to stay in your life, they will find the good in you and you will be able to repair and it won't all be like this all the time. Then it allows you to kind of stand up for yourself once in a while and maybe even take into consideration what the people around you are saying, that maybe there is something they're saying that there you need to actually take into consideration and learn and grow from, and still yet say, you know what, I'm going to take that piece of advice, but actually I know myself a little bit more than you know me, and I'm going to go ahead and stick with this because this is what's going to be best for me. That is, I mean, that's maybe one of my best achievements.
I love that. Same. I do the same. I'm like, okay, I can take that part, but this part, I know myself a little bit better to know that like that doesn't fit for me or whatever it is. And I love what you're saying because it's so difficult. I mean, social rejection is so painful. I was just talking about this with someone where, you know, there have been research has found that the same areas of the brain that are active when we experience emotional pain and like social rejection is the same areas that register physical pain. So it's like, it literally is painful. And I agree with you. It's so important to practice this as a skill. And I think it's helpful if you can practice it in safe places first, whether that is in therapy. Like, for example, in therapy, we might do role playing, right? Like we might role play a situation, like say this happens, how can you respond, right? That's a safe place to role play some of these scenarios to be a little bit thought out about maybe how you can respond in these situations or give yourself some promptings until it becomes a more natural part of your life. So that it can definitely be practiced recognizing those safe people and spaces where you can fully be yourself, where you feel safe, where you come most alive, because I truly believe that we come most alive in the spaces where our nervous system feels safe. Like you really see yourself come out, and recognizing that and practicing it with those people. Because like you said, healthy, differentiated people, they're just easier to be around. Because I really believe that we, like people who have a good sense of boundaries for themselves, respect and honor boundaries in others. It's those who don't have a sense of boundaries that overstep other people's boundaries. And just because someone else doesn't have a sense of healthy boundaries doesn't mean that you drop yours, right? Sometimes we have to show that example of what that looks like because they don't have any. And so I think what's nice about differentiated people is that they recognize that it's okay to have difference, and that doesn't mean a break in love, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean like a break in the relationship. I mean, me and Ranella, like we're so similar, but we also have differences in the way that we have thought about things, or even like in the past have thought about the podcast or approaches to things. And like, we just talk them out. And even though, and I know like every time, even you and I have a conversation, it's like, okay, just because we have a different approach or a different way of thinking about something, it doesn't mean that any love is lost or that that's a threat to our friendship or that, right? Like to me, it's like, it's safe, like, okay, you know? And so I think for people who in this, hey, I've been here too. There's growth for everyone. But I think if you notice, there are people who like don't, who are threatened by difference or threatened by difference of thought. And they kind of try to like claw you back in like, oh no, like you're thinking differently, or oh no, like I see you, I don't know, going in this direction, or you don't think what I think. Well, I need to convince you. You have to think what I think. Like, you know, like to me, that's like, oh, like for one, it makes me feel like you kind of have a fear-based thought process because it's heavily ruled by control versus love. Love says you can be different from me. And that doesn't take away the love within the relationship. Right. So, you know, for me, that's when I can kind of recognize like, oh, okay. Like, differentiation is not like a value system, whether it's in your like religious beliefs or it's within your personal beliefs or values or in your framework of the world, because a person feels threatened by that difference or feels the need to control your thought process or claw you back in anytime that you show a sign of difference, of opinion, of thought, of being, right? That's often a sign that that person either is not differentiated or doesn't understand differentiation or has been kind of taught or indoctrinated that differentiation is a bad thing and is a threat. But it's literally how we have, it's literally a skill we need to move through all of humanity at any point in time, whether it's family, work, friendships. Like you need to be able to connect with people
and have difference and not be threatened by it. So yeah, just being aware of that, because I know I've had those situations where it's like, oh, I'm differentiated, but then someone else might not be. And so then they're really like threatened mm-hmm. by you being different, or they're just really desperate to claw you back in.
Yeah.
Right. I know we've both experienced that. We've had conversations. Absolutely. About that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess kind of in closing, what can we...
Yeah.
For people who are maybe struggling to individuate themselves, maybe they are in families or in a situation where they feel, you know, maybe they just have the type of personality where they don't feel like they are enough, or that they need to, they like have to conform in order to have that sense of safety with the people around them, and they're wanting to grow in their own sense of self and kind of like just care less about what people think. Maybe we can just give them some takeaways or things that they can work on and practice. Yeah,
quick tips. I think for me, a quick tip is I am just, again, like we said, going back to acceptance about who people are and managing realistic expectations with people. For me, that means I'm very aware of like the limits of certain conversations with certain people, where it's like, oh, okay, I can't maybe have this type of conversation with this person, or, you know, in order to kind of protect my mental health, or I feel confident about who and where I am. You know, so I don't need to prove myself to this person or what have you. So I say that to say, maybe consider having boundaries around your conversations. I think that sometimes we think we need to tell everyone everything all the time, and some of that is an indoctrination around an imbalanced sense of accountability without context. And it's just like, no, like maybe during this process of individuating, like you are deciding to put boundaries around certain conversations that you've deemed, okay, it's not really safe to have this conversation with this person, or they're not ready for this type of conversation. And then recognizing those that you can have conversations with as you're growing, as you're evolving, as you're trying to build a more secure sense of self. Again, practice with the safe people. And then as you get stronger and stronger with that, you can kind of find that security and that foundation and that language to carry over into some of those more difficult relationships.
I love that. Yeah, I think if you're on the journey of learning how to care more about what you think and feel than how other people think and feel of you, a great thing to do is to spend some time by yourself. Take Yes. yourself on some solo dates. And I'm not saying this to, I don't know, like, I'm not even saying in the most fluffy way, like literally you might not even enjoy it. You might not like it at first, but when you start doing things for yourself, by yourself, it's scary, but it allows you to see that like you're actually okay and safe with you. Yeah. And also, when you have an experience with a friend or a family member or someone, a stranger on the internet that says something about you, start noticing what's happening in your body. Start mm-hmm. noticing if you're starting to kind of have those anxious racing thoughts about who you are, if you're starting to feel low in self-worth. Start just noticing when that happens. And maybe when that starts happening, you have a journal or a friend that you talk to, that you write things down, that you remind yourself who you are, because you're really literally rewriting your story, your narratives, and you're reshaping your brain chemistry. So you're basically telling your brain, oh, hey, wait, stop. We don't want to go there. Actually, we're going to do this instead. This is how we feel about ourselves. This is what we're reminding ourselves. We're reminding ourselves that like, I matter, I'm worthy, I'm worth, you know, listening to, I'm worth actually speaking up and saying something because my opinion does matter. I'm worth this boundary. So like literally just reframing and rewriting that story in real time begins with noticing when you start going down that spiral of like low self-worth and feeling like, okay, I'm just going to minimize myself for someone else. And it takes practice. And if you can surround yourself with those types of people that you can express this to and they can affirm you and say, no, you're amazing. This is what you deserve. This is what you should do. Like, it's always great to hear that as well. But the more you talk about it and even talk about, hey, this is what I'm struggling mm-hmm. with, this is what I'm trying to work on, the more your brain will catch on that, like, hey, this is the direction we want to start going now. And then it's just a matter of practicing it over and over again. So that's what
I would say. So good. I love that. Oh, this is why I love the Q&A episodes. It's just like, again, like, yeah, not only connect with us on Instagram at Speaking Our Minds Pod, but let us know your thoughts, your mm-hmm. questions. We want to continue to explore these questions with you guys. You know, Ranelle and I try to come up with topics that we think are really important and relevant, but we also love diving into some of the questions that you guys have, many of which we wholeheartedly relate to.
Yeah.
So yeah, thanks so much for your questions. Thanks so much for listening. Be sure to continue listening all month long because we have some more topics on the horizon, kind of expounding on some of the things that we talked about here. So tune in next time.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's episode, let's continue the conversation and stay connected on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, all linked in the show notes below. Let us know your thoughts or leave a review on the podcast. Your feedback really does mean so much to us. Until next time.